My name is John Chatelain, and with Chatelain and Maynard in Omaha, Nebraska. And our client is the appellant here, Mr. Bernie Tompkins and his corporation, which is IOC Realty Specialists Incorporated. And it's my understanding the IOC stands for Industrial Office and Commercial. And brief facts here, Mr. Tompkins is in the business of representing clients in the management of commercial property. In 2003, he entered into a lease with his client Leon Kleinschmidt and Melissa Sapinza. The name of her daycare center was the Alphabet Academy. And this property is at 3427 and 3431 South 42nd Street in Omaha, Nebraska. Then in 2007, Mr. Tompkins was approached by a Mary Chole and the appellee Sam Pan asking to have this lease assigned to them to run a daycare center as well. Then they continued to run the daycare center until 2014 when Mr. Tompkins was approached by the appellee and a company by the name of Signer Ben America. For some reason, Mary Chole was no longer involved in the case. And appellee informed Mr. Tompkins that he was selling his property to Signer Ben America as a part of the sale of the daycare center, and informed Mr. Tompkins that all the personal property, both inside and outside of the building, was going along with the sale. Mr. Tompkins then executed a new lease on behalf of Millard Television, which was a corporation owned by the Kleinschmidts, on July 31st of 2014. Signer Ben America paid rent at first, but then as the fall came along, they stopped paying rent, and Mr. Tompkins made the assumption that they had vacated the property. In December of 2014, then he re-let the property to Sophia Mayorga with Mayorga Enterprises, LLC, to run her daycare center, the Adventure Time Academy. Then he started receiving correspondence from an attorney for the appellee, Willow Head, asking for the return of that property.
Was there any communication between the husband prior to?
I don't believe so. I believe there was
contacts or telephone contacts?
I don't believe there was any correspondence or any communication between Mr. Pan and the appellant until he started receiving correspondence from the appellee's attorney. She started requesting the return of the property. She submitted a couple of statements purporting to be on behalf of the president of Signer Ben America, stating that all the property belonged to Mr. Pan. Under the circumstances, Mr. Tompkins was a little bit reluctant to rely on these statements because of the situation. He didn't know the parties involved and assumed that they might be working in collusion. And if he turned the property over to the appellee, then he could be getting a claim from Signer Ben America for the property. Communication continued. At some point, Mr. Tompkins asked for an indemnification agreement from appellee, and then suit started in the summer of 2015.
Was there any response to the indemnification
no.
request?
No, the indemnification agreement was never provided. There were the two statements purportedly to be from the president of Signer Ben America stating that the property belonged to Sam Pan. Because of the situation, because Mr. Pan had informed Mr. Tompkins that he had sold the daycare center to Signer Ben America and all of the personal property in the business as well.
Did he sold it or
Well, he said he had sold it and all of the property needing to be used in the daycare was being assigned to the president of Signer Ben America. After the trial was over, the district court awarded judgment against my client for $10,000 for damages and $10,000 of attorney fees. We're requesting that this court reverse that judgment, and we've asked you to find that the district court made a number of errors, that Signer Ben America should have been a party to the case. So one of the assignments has to do with indispensable parties. The district court admitted the two statements that I've referred to over our objection. We objected that they were hearsay. The district court admitted them, saying they were not relied upon for the contents of those statements, but only to show that the statements had been submitted to my client. We're arguing that in a replevin action, the remedy is the return of the property. My clients were always willing to return the property to its rightful owner, but they didn't know who owned it.
Why did the replevin action or why did the statute?
Well, that's a good question, and it was a little bit unclear. The case was filed as a replevin action, and in that type of case, the remedy is the return of the property. Only secondarily would be a money damage ordered.
Filed as a replevin action, was it tried as a replevin?
It was tried as a replevin action, but also the case focused on the Disposition of Personal Property Landlord-Tenant Act. And it's our contention that that act does not apply to general commercial leases. There was not proper evidence for the court to determine that the property was worth $10,000. There was no testimony provided that the court could make a determination that was the proper value to any degree of certainty. I believe it's a legal standard, and so this court has a duty to decide that independent of the district court's decision. The question of the measure of damages is a legal question. If the proper evidence is supports the measure of damages, then it could become a fact decision. But there has to be a methodology first. As an example, the court simply cut the amount in half. Mr. Pan had asked for $29,000. The court removed the things that the court found to be fixtures and then divided the remainder in half. And that is not a proper measure of damages. Suppose the plaintiff had asked for $1 million and alleged that the property was worth $1 million. Would the court then say that the judgment is $500,000? At some point, I think the court's error would be revealed if you follow that line of thinking.
Isn't the measure of damages the value of the personal property? Isn't that what the court purported to be? I understand you may disagree with the result, but isn't the measure of damages the value of the property?
The value of the property at the time of trial. But there has to be some evidence so that the court can find the value of the property to a reasonable degree of certainty and not simply cut the baby in half, which is what the court's method was.
And that didn't, in your view, that did not happen to coincide with a proper measure?
Correct. The testimony by the defendant and the third party a defendant was that the property was trashed, it was broken, it was bug infested, it had virtually no value. And the third party defendant said it was not hers, she couldn't use it, she had to get it out of there so she could run her business because it was too dirty and too trashy. So it was our position that the property had virtually no value, and the court just cut the values in half, removing those items that were fixtures and then cutting the rest in half.
what effect would our legal conclusion that the Act does apply to commercial leases have on the disposition of this case?
Well, it appears that the plaintiff sort of veered into the Disposition of Personal Property Act at the time of trial in order to get attorney fees, because I don't believe there's any provision for attorney fees generally. But the Act provides for attorney fees.
Is there any objection to veering the way you've described it? Is there an objection right now?
Yes, we objected to the offering of the affidavit of attorney fees because it was based on the Disposition of Personal Property Landlord-Tenant Act outside the replevin.
Does that turn that into a legal action? Legal in nature?
I think
under the Act?
I think it's a question, the question of whether the Disposition of Landlord-Tenant Act applies to commercial leases is a legal question that this court can decide.
And then what's the form of action as a result of that, were that to be the law? The legal action?
Well,
equitable and so forth.
It's a legal action based on that act. And it should have been started that way. The case should have started under the Disposition of Landlord-Tenant Act, but it started as a replevin action.
Hearing, as you described it, is that one of the errors that you've assigned on appeal?
Our error that we've assigned is that the court found that the Disposition of Personal Property Landlord-Tenant Act applies to general commercial leases. And if you look at the Act, the definitional portions in the definition of a landlord, it talks about self-storage units exclusively. The definition of a tenant, it talks about self-storage units and dwellings, no other types of properties. This court ruled in Bedrosky versus Heiner that commercial leases are to be treated differently than residential leases, which are governed by the Nebraska Landlord-Tenant Act.
What's a self-storage unit? Is that a commercial activity?
A self-storage unit is a limited type of property. It's not residential. It's a limited type of commercial property, I would say. But that type of property is specifically addressed in the Act. Commercial leases are treated differently than residential leases.
It's a different issue, though, isn't it?
This court has determined that they can be treated differently and that leases can exculpate around legal provisions, which you can't do with a residential lease.
That issue's not.
Correct.
That's color. That's to educate us on the difference.
Correct. Yes, commercial leases are clearly different than residential leases, and the relationship between the parties is addressed within the terms of the lease. It's unlike the residential situation where you have the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act, which defines the relationships between the parties, and the landlord cannot exculpate themselves around those provisions. I'm quite a bit over my time. I'm sorry about that, but we're requesting that the court would reverse the decision of the district court and remove the burden upon my client for those damages.
Thank you very much. Ms. Head, good morning to you.
Good morning. Chief Justice Evakin, Justices of the Supreme Court, Mr. Chatterling, may it please the court. My name is Willow Head, and I represent the appellee, Sam Pan, in this action. This is an appeal to Douglas County District Court, Judge Schatz presiding. First, I would address the standard of review. I believe the standard of review is high in this case. This court recently stated that the court will not reevaluate the credibility of witnesses or reevaluate the evidence. They will look for clear error. And here in this case, Judge Schatz made findings that was supported by the record, was supported by the evidence and the testimony of the witnesses, and I'm asking this court to affirm the lower court's decision. This is a very simple case. This is about an individual took advantage of another individual for his own financial gain.
It was filed as a replevin action?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
And it was maintained as a replevin action?
In the complaint, the amended complaint, the statute for replevin is cited, but it also provides that the court may seek any other remedy that is just in this premises. With regards to the allegations contained in the complaint, I believe...
Isn't replevin an action of law?
Yes, Your Honor.
And aren't you talking about equitable relief? This just and equitable business, isn't that the standard pleading for an equity case?
Well, it is prayed for at the end of the complaint, but yes, you are correct. But I do not believe that the statutes and the relief under the disposition of the Personal Property Landlord-Tenant Act is mutually exclusive. The allegations that are contained within the complaint support the request and the relief provided for in the statute. The evidence is much the same. And this court, again recently in the Zelenka case, indicated that with notice pleadings, the conversion replevin was the issue in that case, that the parties knew what the matter was, knew what the issues were, and so it would have been ideal to conform the evidence to the pleadings, a request made, but at the end of the day, during the trial, opposing counsel knew the relief that was sought was both under the replevin as well as the relief sought under Statute 692301, which is the Disposition of Personal Property Landlord-Tenant Act.
When did the veering take place in the proceedings? When did 692301 come up?
Well, it came up mostly for summary judgment as well as pursuant to pretrial orders. I wrote a brief as required by a pretrial order that requested legal authority that would be relied upon during the time of trial. That is served 10 days in advance to opposing counsel. And I did cite this act, this statute, as means to support the position. The replevin, initially, my client wanted the return of his personal property. That's what this was about. He wanted his daycare property back. This is someone who came over in America, was a refugee, and this is his livelihood. In 2007, he signed a lease, and in 2014, he had built a daycare business and had his personal property contained in this building. He wanted it back, so we asked for a replevin.
Do you agree that opposing counsel interposed an objection to the application of the disposition of personal property landlord and tenant?
No. The only thing that he cites in this assignment of error is that it doesn't apply to commercial property. He never, during the trial, beforehand, there was no motion in limine, there was nothing that would suggest that he objected to the relief requested.
Then I want to turn to the definition of landlord in that act, which your opposing counsel talked about, but perhaps did not quote the entire phrase. Talks about landlord means owner, lessor, sublessor, and I get to the important language, of furnished or unfurnished premises, including self-service storage units or facilities. Is the correct interpretation of that, does self-service storage units or facilities limit the general phrase?
No, it
and
does not.
What's your best argument why it does not?
Because it would say, the strict interpretation of the statute would then say this includes only. It would be restrictive in nature. The including self-storage unit or facilities merely cites examples or includes additional items to the furnished or unfurnished premises. If you go down to subsection 3, which then further defines premises, it says it's a building that, you know, and it goes into what all consists of buildings and surrounding areas. So I do not think the landlord, when it talks about self-storage unit. It only applies to self-storage unit. I think it includes that in addition to furnished or unfurnished premises, which is then further defined down in the statute. Yes, Your Honor. Nowhere in this act does it preclude or restrict the application to commercial leases or in this action at all, Your Honor. With regards to other issues that were addressed by opposing counsel, the value of the property, as this court correctly indicated, is the measure of the value of the personal property, is the measure of the damages in this case. My client provided Exhibit 14 was an itemized list that showed the items as well as his personal opinion as to the value. He purchased all of these items for his daycare. There was also bank records and credit card statements. But this, again, came in without objection, and there was no evidence to the contrary. Opposing counsel did not offer his own opinion or say it had a different value. So that was the evidence that the court adopted. Because again, it was offered without objection.
And did his sales agreement play part of that?
So with regards to, I do not think the court took that in consideration, but there was a contract that the defendant was not a part of to sell the business, and that is what my client was advising Mr. Tompkins, that he was selling the business. Consideration was not made, but in that transaction, he was buying the business for $30,000. So my client did testify to that during the time of trial, but I do not think that that came into play when Judge Schatz valued the property. And the reason there was a monetary compensation is because Mr. Tompkins still had not returned the property. I mean, this is back from 2014, and we're in trial in May and June in 2017, and Mr. Tompkins still had not returned any of the personal property to my client. And that question was specifically addressed on day two of the trial by the court asking, has any of the personal property been returned? The answer was no. So the monetary damages was the correct remedy, as well as the award of attorney fees.
Did the trial court say something to the effect of an impossibility with respect to other forms of relief, or just went into the monetary calculation?
As far as, I guess I don't know that for sure, but the concern by Mr. Pan was that one daycare had been using half of his property in their new daycare business, and the other part of the property was being stored at some warehouse that was not temperature controlled and had been there for 4 years. So who knew what condition the property was going to be in. And my client is entitled to the value of the property at the time of the conversion, or the time that it was taken from him, which again was in August 2014. Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next